Hi, this is Melissa, and welcome to another episode of From the Outset, brought to you by Outset Ventures. Today we have Anvil, CEO and co-founder of Denison Technologies. Anvil, co-founder Kim, and their team of material scientists and engineers have created Auraflex, an artificial muscle technology that is revolutionizing soft robotics and wearable tech. Join me and Anvil as we talk about Denison's journey from inception to the amazing, limitless possibilities Auraflex brings to the market.
Denison Technologies, I founded back in June 2020, middle of COVID. I was in the Air Force at that time as an engineering officer. Because of the lockdown, there was a lot of time in between working and staying at home, and that was... As bad as that whole experience was for a lot of people, I think one of the benefits I had of it was getting some time to really think about the company. Well, I didn't even know it was going to be a company at that time, but really thinking about my passions in life and what I wanted to do. Part of that was my dad. So before I joined the Air Force, I went to University of Waikato. I studied mechanical engineering, and in my fourth year, I decided, look, I really want to do something for my dad. My dad had polio from a very young age. He had it from the age of one, and I saw a lot of the struggle with that. Not just physically, but the emotional struggles around that as well. It's one thing not being able to walk around like everyone else or do chores or do simple things, but it's little things like keeping pace, walking with the rest of the family. You start feeling very excluded. So when my family would walk, my sister and I and my mom and dad, it would always be my sister and my mom, and then my dad and I always trailing behind, and I always trailed with my dad because I didn't want him to be alone. But getting that perspective made me feel like, because I would be with my dad, like, I see how you feel, And so I did my fourth year engineering project on exoskeletons. I got it up to a proof of concept, and so after university, went to the Air Force. COVID hit, and I just wasn't satisfied with it just being in the proof of concept form. To me, the mantra since then has always been, it has to be on people helping people. I wasn't going to settle for a proof of concept that was just going to stay on a piece of A4 paper, and I decided to start a company. It really is rooted around my dad, hence the name Denison, because my dad's name is Dennis. Contrary to what people think, that it's like Dennis's son, it actually means Dennis and son.
You and Kimberly, how did that partnership?
Yeah, that's a good question. Another question that I always get asked is, did I marry Kim after Denison before? It was before. We met in university, third year, got together. I proposed before I went to the military. When I came back, we got married, and then COVID happened. For me, when I started Denison, I wasn't looking for Kim to join me at that time. Kim actually had her own startup at that time, making her own brand of clay jewelry, home decor, etc. And I really wanted her to work on that, but she was actually the one who convinced me that I needed her to be part of the company. A lot of what we do is advanced materials, a new class of materials even, and she has a background in that. I'm a mechanical engineer. She's a chemical and process engineer, and part of that is materials. We honestly thought it was going to be a quick run, but it takes longer than that. But yeah, that's how we became co-founders.
Looking back at your early days, are there any key lessons that you, in hindsight, would have done differently?
Great question. If I was to do things differently, and if I put it in the context of the last round, before we got Creepy Finger prototype, I think I would have spent more time engaging and not just keeping plans in my head. I tend to have a tendency of planning everything. One of the biggest lessons I learned was a plan inside my head is not a plan, it's an idea. And in order to execute a plan, I have to not just do it myself, but I had to do it well informed and really have that guidance with advisors. We did, but I feel like if there's anything I could have done differently was probably asking for help earlier and asking for support earlier, instead of, I guess, like going with a bulldozer approach of like, I'm just going to do everything myself. So that's one. The other lesson learned is really in regards to with the R&D, as quick as it's progressed, there were definitely times where I was very cautious, especially the early days, so very cautious of putting it into something like an equipment or a tool or or a contractor. And I think that's the lack of just understanding what the benefits of those things are versus the benefit of, again, doing it ourselves or just waiting. If I could do things again, I would probably be less inclined to be so reserved, you know, and be more, you know, like, not saying we wouldn't think critically about what we would spend on. We definitely think critically on it, but be a bit more executive with it in terms of not sitting on their hand too long with it. And I think that just comes with experience. When you're growing, you don't know if it's a worthwhile expense. That's something that we've changed now. We're a lot more agile now when it comes to making those decisions.
For those who don't know what artificial muscles and soft robotics is, could you give us a quick explanation?
Yeah, what we're developing, which we call Auraflex, is an artificial muscle. It's a platform, meaning that you can use it for many different things. And an artificial muscle, in our context, is essentially a type of actuator, which is just, in layman's terms, that's just something that allows things to move from point A to point B. So motors, pneumatics, hydraulics. But it's a type of actuator that is very soft, very flexible, and very bio-inspired to the human muscle. The reason we went for that is because we needed something very compact, lightweight, and flexible. We wanted something that wasn't super rigid, something that didn't have a lot of complexity. Auraflex reflects a lot of what the human muscle does. You know, it's very much bio-inspired. It's not a biological muscle, as some people might think. We don't grow lab-grown muscles in the lab, but it's something that we synthesize in the lab ourselves, but it's not a biological tissue.
I don't know if you're quite there yet, but how would you trigger it? Does it some way connect with your brain, or like how exactly is that?
I see that the input, yeah. So there are many ways to trigger it depending on application. The simplest ways to trigger it are through just a normal button. You would have a very simple control system where you press the button, it stimulates the material starts to contract, and then you can press the button again, and then it turns off and the material starts to relax again. Very similar to, you can kind of think about it like that whole interaction is like the nervous system and the muscle in the human body, where the nervous system sends electrical signals, the muscle then contracts based off of that. And so that would be the simplest way of controlling it if you were to use it as something that can adjust, like for clothing that can adjust tightness. Yeah. You could have like an app on your phone potentially, and then you can just adjust it using dials or buttons, and then it can contract to the size that you want and adjust to the size that you want. That's one example. Some of the more futuristic examples are having a brain computer interface. So the control system can take the input from the brain or from the muscles themselves, from existing muscles, and using that to then control the artificial muscles, the Auraflex muscles that we synthesize. But really it depends on the application and the complexity that's required.
At what point did you look at Auraflex and think, well, I've really got something here?
We were working with a completely different material. It was fairly slow. We had to rethink our approach, and we used another material, the one similar to what we're using now. It's had a lot of iteration. And I think it was really just that first bending movement. I remember we were in the lab and we had a tiny little sample, literally like 8 millimeters by 5 millimeters. Very thin, like 50 microns thin at that stage. And we just had it on like a little clamp, and we just blasted it with light, and just not knowing what was going to happen, and just seeing it curl towards the light. You know, nothing's interacting with it. Nothing's attached to it. It's just reacting to the light, similar to how like plants try and find sunlight and they start facing towards it, but faster. I think that was the first time I looked at Kim and I was like, I think we really have something here. You know, let's make something with this. And we did. And that's how we created Creepy Finger. Yeah. So I'm not the one who named it Creepy Finger Prototype. You can thank Matt and Angus for that one.
How does it compare to what, let's say, someone like your father would normally have to use?
So my dad currently uses a static leg brace. The very obvious differentiation points are that it's static, so it locks the knee into a straight position, and that can cause a lot of issues over time. You bend your knee to dampen your walk, so the absorption isn't quite there. You have things called hip hiking, where it is, you know, you can't actually bend your knee to get clearance, and so you have to like swing your knee outward, your whole leg outwards, which causes a whole bunch of different problems with the hip. And so just having it static just wasn't good. And just imagine trying to go upstairs without bending your knees. It limits a lot. The alternative to that that exists are exoskeletons, which are either motorized or using pneumatics, which is compressed air. And as sci-fi and as cool as that approach is, you know, kind of thinking like Iron Man, the biggest thing I found, especially for my thesis, is that it's bulky and clunky. It's a lot of weight, and because of that, you have to be Tony Stark to afford it. Not everyone has that in the bank, right? It had a long way to go, especially even right now. I mean, just even the control systems have a long way to go, although that's getting better. The biggest issue, because I wanted it to be compact, I wanted it to be comfortable for the user. And the biggest thing that stood out to me when I did my thesis was, well, these actuators are huge. It's not the sensors. The sensors can be really small. It's not the battery. Well, the battery depends on how they use time and everything, but the battery technology is getting really power dense. The biggest thing that was stopping this from being a comfortable solution that works around a soft system like the human body are the actuators. They're very clunky, they're very rigid. You know, if you think of motors, they're cylindrical and they're rotary. And then in order to transfer that into something like a linear motion, I'm getting a bit nerdy here, but you know, you have to use gearboxes, you have to use cables, and then, you know, a whole bunch of different components, all of that adds weight. It just wasn't cutting it for me. And so if anything was gonna make things more compact and more fit to us as a human system, the actuators had to change, which is probably one of the hardest things to do, but we thought, you know, we'll tackle that problem anyway, and see where we go. It's the compactness. It's having it something lightweight. It all revolves around the human comfort and human performance side.
Would you be able to use it for anything else?
Just to clarify, we're not building an exoskeleton at this stage.
Yeah.
What we have is a way of enabling the building of things like exoskeletons and other things using an actuation platform that can fit in a slimmer package. Some of the applications that key customers are interested right now in the short term are things like adaptive fit and active compression in clothing garments. That doesn't need to be an exoskeleton. It could just be normal clothing, activewear, sportswear. Adaptive fit is essentially having clothing that can adjust to everyone's biomechanical differences. Things like shirts, sports bras, shoes, and active compression being another step on top of that, which is it's not just fitting, but it's actively compressing. And so you can think of compression stockings, but they're quite passive. So their systems are just applying pressure consistently. But imagine a compression stocking that can apply pressure actively. So it can actually pump the blood up or down the leg and facilitate blood flow. Those are things that our muscles can do right now with their current performance. And then the future performance aspects of the muscles are things like assistive wearables. So wearables that can assist the movement. You use it antagonistically. Now you have resistive wearables, which are resisting the movement, which can be used for either assistive tasks such as lifting objects for workplace use, or assisting people from, for example, workplace overuse. The resistive aspects can be used for things like rehabilitation, having someone resist a variable force for like hand rehabilitation, for example. The other one that's a little more sci-fi is used for astronaut suits for microgravity environments. So in microgravity, you don't have any of those gravitational inertial forces that you have in Earth. It affects bone density, it affects your muscles, so you get muscular dystrophy. And by having something that is resisting by 1G, you can actually have something that can prevent those effects in microgravity environment. Not to mention all of the soft robotic applications. That's a bit of a buzzword, but soft robotics is essentially any kind of robotics that requires a high degree of softness and compliance, which means that you have systems that you can shake a robot's hand and there's no or very minimal risk of it hurting you because the system is very soft and not just made of very rigid parts and rigid actuators and things like that. So there's a whole host there as well.
What would you say were your biggest challenges so far?
The challenge right now is it's currently on the lab scale. Even though we're developing prototypes now and developing kits for people to integrate and use, the quality of the muscles aren't up to spec just yet. It's enough for people to be able to have a feel and understand how it works into their systems. But the next stage is being able to have that equipment in-house to be able to increase the quality of our production of the muscles. The challenge is having uniformity and quality in sample, which we know we can't be done at lab scale, but can be done with a more automated process.
And then where do you see this technology? Where do you see that going in the next 10 years?
I think it's going to be in everything that requires slim movement. Really, you know, when I call it a platform, I mean that it is a true platform. You know, you can use it for adaptive fit, compression, assistive mobility, resistive mobility. You can use it for any kind of soft linear actuation, whether that's maritime, automotive, aerospace, workplace, logistics. And you can use it for tasks, for example, specifically tasks that and that we haven't tested this fully, but because we have very little metallic parts, it's really good in extreme environments where metallics may suffer, like saltwater environments. Aerospace is going to be a big one, because with aerospace, it's always about being able to send equipment and people up to space with very little mass, you know, as lightweight as possible, as compact as possible, to save on fuel, to save on space. And it allows for those things. Yeah, if you ask me in 10 years' time, where is Denison? Denison is everywhere. Denison's ubiquitous.
Where does sustainability fit into your mission?
Yeah, sustainability for us will be mainly around ensuring that we are being very thoughtful and ethical with our engineering and manufacturing life cycle. I, for one, when I did my university career, chose to study in my final year more closely sustainability engineering. And so I understand the process of doing environmental impact assessments and life cycle analyses to ensure that at every stage of your value chain, you're considering, you know, ethical sourcing, you're considering what the materials are being used and whether there's any sustainable alternatives to those materials, and just being very aware as a company of our environmental footprint and making sure that we're at every step of that value chain, we are dedicating ourselves to reducing and minimizing any detrimental environmental footprint that we may have. We're not necessarily a green tech company. I wouldn't label ourselves as a green tech company. We're mainly a technology company that is promoting mobility, physical freedom through mobility, and in other movements as well, whether that's wearable or non-wearable. But just making sure that we are, once we build that full value chain, making sure that we're on top of trying to reduce our footprint wherever we can. It's going to be important for us.
So you've got a prototype. Could you walk us through that specific prototype and where you're at with that?
So just to put into context, the original prototype was Creepy Finger prototype.
Yes.
It is a 50th scale prototype of a human hand, moving one finger back and forth by only a few millimeters, just to kind of show that there's a possibility of this becoming a more full scale actuation system. The current prototype that we took on a roadshow last year is a 1-to-1 scale prototype of a human hand. It's a wearable garment, so it actually is an active wear garment that goes around the hand, essentially a glove, but we have the Auraflex modules lined onto the glove. And so when the modules actuate, they move all the thumb, the index finger, and the middle finger together to do a pinching motion. So that movement is, we've been able to do it in a much fuller range. You know, it's a controlled movement at this stage. We're not going for very fast movements. There is a possibility of doing that for certain applications. But yeah, but it was mainly to demonstrate we can do it in full scale. We can do it as a wearable. We can do it in a way, in a form factor that's very lightweight, very flexible, and very compact.
And then with Roger, what was the feedback?
A lot of customer interest. A lot of customer interest. We've talked to both wearable companies in the activewear and sportswear space, soft robotics companies in automotive, in humanoid robotics, in maritime, everything was very positive. It's very clear that for the activewear side, that they're not just looking for function. You know, if they were just looking for function, they'd use any kind of motor out there, and that'll suffice. but they need something that can provide function while maintaining aesthetics, yeah, while maintaining something compact. And so it's not function, it's form and function. And form and function is Denison's forte. The same thing can be said with the soft robotic applications as well, as being able to save space, you know, like having a humanoid hand not weigh 5 kgs, but weighs closer to what a human hand is, which is 500 grams. Those are the things that we believe are possible with this type of system. They're very interested in ordering some form of development kit from us. Yeah, and we're trying to move the dial forward on that so that we can work with our key customers more closely and for testing and feedback and understanding their requirements better.
And then did you go on your roadshow? Was this local, New Zealand, or did you go international?
This is international. So we went to Canada, the US, and United Kingdom as well.
And this was in December?
Yes, November.
November, yes. Okay. I think obviously your product is very unique. Do you see any competitors in your field?
Yeah. There are competitors in the field, depending on which one you're referring to. Traditional competitors that use traditional approaches like motors and pneumatics. Yes, there are competitors there. We're quite confident at this stage that, especially when it comes to the wearable side, that we can beat them in form factor. Because the technology that we're using doesn't have to be stuck with a traditional form factor that's cylindrical, motorized. You know, we don't need compressors or tubes or heavy metallics. We reduce all of that with our design. In the alternative actuation route, other people working with smart materials similar to ourselves, there are competitors there. A main one that people like to use is shape memory alloys, for example, which can provide similar actuation forces. But we've got a few advantages, we believe, in that regard as well. When it comes to slimness, the thickness of our material is much slimmer and something that you can layer much more easily in future designs. And one of the other aspects of our design is some muscles, not shape memory alloys, other muscles can contract about the same as ours, but you have to use kilovolts of electricity to cause any form of contraction. And with ours, especially in a wearable context, we really wanted to focus on safety, and we wanted to ensure that we had a system that didn't have high voltages running through them. And so ours is optically isolated. We're not working anywhere near those same voltages. So there are definitely people in the field that can see the advantages of these types of new classes of material, or artificial muscle materials. Yeah, and I guess the other advantage that I believe we have at the moment with what's out there is we have a product that people are looking for. With the development kits that are ready to integrate out of the box. We're really thinking of this for the customer and how we can really make it as simple as possible for customers to integrate this into their systems and take all of the guesswork out of it.
Yep. I would just say Denison's business model has evolved since inception.
So how it's evolved was, I started the company as a medical device company. I quickly found that I do want this to go into medical, but it will take time. And I really wanted to figure out where our lower hanging fruits are in terms of bringing value to the industry. And so we started looking into virtual reality in terms of force feedback haptics and how that could implement there. We also looked into soft robotics. We looked into activewear. It was really with this intent of figuring out where do we fit and how do we engage with people. And we found that with the current specs of the product, it worked well with systems in the activewear, sportswear side, and just in active garments, just garments in particular. With regards to the model, it's really changed from initially going and exploring, hey, I'm going to make a medical device, to going, actually, the main issue is not that people aren't making devices, they're just not making devices that are cost-effective, comfortable, and lightweight. And the main issue of that is the actuator. And so we focused on not being a device company, like a product company, in the sense that it's a final product, but a technology company that provides a new type of technology that enables products to be more cost-effective, lightweight, and flexible. Compact. What we're adopting right now is essentially a model where we have an actuation technology that can integrate readily into those systems, into those wearable systems in particular, that can then enable them to provide a better product offering to their customers. With activewear, sportswear, any kind of clothing right now, it's all very static, but providing almost a new form of clothing, which would be the powered clothing. And Denizen's just that little label on the side that enables that.
How has funding played a role in Denizen's journey, specifically from companies like Outsafe?
Yeah, when I first started Denizen, I was very naive when it comes to funding. And so I was actually thinking of bootstrapping it the entire time. And then it wasn't until I met Outset, who were level two at the time, when they helped me realize, look, there's a lot more cost involved. There's going to be a lot more nuances in R&D. You'll need the money for that. To fund that, you'll need more than just yourself. You'll probably need a team. The funding has helped in many ways. The funding has helped with allowing us to have the space to work in. Materials companies in particular, it's very difficult to do it outside of a lab environment. It's not impossible, but what I found was it's not a good look when your house is full of test tubes and boilers and you're trying to order chemicals and they ask, why is it a residential address? And you try and you try and reassure them, no, I'm doing something legitimate. It's very difficult, and they allowed us to, the funding's allowed us to have our own laboratory that is registered, that is compliant, that we can actually order chemicals in and start doing R&D. And thanks to that, 100% of the IP is ours. We didn't have to associate ourselves with any institutions, universities. And the other part is the people. I wasn't going to be able to do this myself. I needed the right people on board, and the funding helped us find the right engineers to really push this through. My founding engineering team is the best. They are the A team that I was hoping for, and they've pushed the boundaries into places I've never thought I'd see it. The funding has allowed us to be able to take care of that team and make sure that, especially in the current climate, make sure that they're taken care of and they're coming to work as their best selves, and they have security in the current climate as well. Yeah, so it's building the team, it's having the space, it's more than just the funding. I think it's all of the intangible value of having the right partners such as Outset that provides so much more value outside of the scope of just funding, just the support, just being there to soundboard ideas, and we're, Kim and I, we acknowledge, when we started it, we were quite young founders, and they supported us to really grow and help us answer. It's more helping us answer the questions that we didn't even know were questions we should be asking. It's all of those things together, yeah.
Are there any upcoming funding rounds?
Yes, so I am doing my funding round now. We are starting to talk to New Zealand investors, and we're also talking to investors in the UK, the US, and Canada, as well as Australia and Singapore. Yeah, we're making some headway there at this stage, and if there's any investors that are interested in being part of the journey, I'm more than happy to engage, especially with New Zealand investors. We've got the prototype up and running in the lab, and more than happy to showcase that as well.
How does Denizen ensure transparency and accountability to its investors and stakeholders?
That's a really great question. We ensure that they're up to date as much as possible from a non-governance side. That's through being able to update them through newsletters. I have updated investors directly before. If it was specific to their expertise, we would engage with them and be like, hey, look, for one, it's for us to really soundboard with someone who's an expert in that field. But also we take the time to update them personally as well during those times. From a governance perspective, it's been a learning journey for Kim and I. We didn't have a governance background as young founders. Having people like our observers in the board guide us through and ensuring that we are keeping all of the governance level decisions transparent and up to date to our investors as much as possible. I guess to summarize, we really do it in two ways. One, we just do it through newsletters, just making sure people are up to date month to month or every 2 months. And then just through ensuring that the governance is done right and we're minuting everything. Yeah.
How did your partnership with Outset begin?
So I went to an NZTE event and I was not too sure where to go at that stage. I was just kind of generally networking in the startup scene. I was at that stage where I'm Googling how to CEO. So I was ground zero. And they said, look, I met up with someone and said, look, if you're looking for lab space, level two outside at the time has that. She put me in contact with Imcha, who was the former CEO, had a chat to her, told her about my company. And then the whole intent of it was, I need some lab space. And so that's the initial time we met, was that. And then she came back to me a few months after and was like, look, we really thought about it. I think what you're doing is really interesting, you know? And I'm like, oh, okay. So you have space available. It's like, yeah, we do, but we'd like to invest in you if you're up for it. I'm like, oh no, that's okay. it's all right. I'm bootstrapping this one, I'll like to take the smallest room cabinet you have, please. They were like, no, look, like I mentioned, there's a lot of nuances to it, I did have a think about it, and I was like, okay, if I really want to make this if I really want to launch this, I really have to do more. That's kind of how we met, and I met with them a second time, and I got to meet Angus, who's currently in Outset on the investment side. And actually, at that time, Angus had just started in Outset, and it was my first day at Outset Ventures as well. And so, yeah, that's how we met. Yeah, it was good. It was just funny that I think back to it. It's always like just the straight rejection from me of like, no, it's okay, I'm bootstrapping it, I just need a lab. But you know, looking in hindsight, you know, their support has been very, very valuable to us. Yeah.
So with the facilities, was it an easy move in? Did they give you a lot of support with that?
Yes. I don't know if they're happy for me to share this, but that's always a good sign. Always a good sign of an interview. When we first moved in, there was still a lot of construction in the building. They were still expanding, and there wasn't too much room. And to be completely honest, it was just Kim and I. They'd actually had a larger space, but they'd squeezed into half of the room. So that was like Angus, Matt, Imcha. They squeezed into one half of the room so that Kim and I could have tables on the other side. That was basically us moving. I mean, like, we didn't have a lot of equipment at that point. We hadn't bought anything big. We hadn't bought a lot of chemicals yet because we were just kind of going in. So it was very easy, but I always kind of look back at that and go like, yeah, like that's kind of nice. That's really nice. It's very, very kind of them to be able to give us some space during that busy period.
Yeah.
Kind of fast forwarding to now, we moved a few times in the building during the construction. We moved down to the basement lab, and then we moved upstairs when level four was finished, and then now we're here in level two again. It's been quite a rodeo, and not in the sense that it wasn't disruptive. It was just, they were growing and we were growing with them.
Yeah.
And even just last year, we were in the lab here in level two, and we didn't expect to grow, and they provided us with more lab space to grow into as well. And now we're pretty much at capacity there now too. It's just that flexibility of being able to provide that, you know, they understand that the companies that walk through their door are high growth companies, startups that will grow very rapidly. And so they provide that very effectively, very, very, very fast.
Would you say that it's a very organic, you know, like with the community, how does that play in with Denison?
With the community, I think it's really good. The community here in Outset is, I think we share a lot of commonalities in being a deep tech space. You know, the struggles that we have, doesn't matter whether you're biomed or you're doing artificial muscles, or you're trying to build a Death Star. You know, like, the struggle is the same. We're all in the same boat. We're all starting up. Yeah, and what's interesting is you've got a diverse community. You've got people who are just starting up, which where we were initially, and now I'd say we're in the stage where we're a little bit more established. We've got a team, we're growing. But during that time, we had people that like Avid Talent. They were later stage, they were operational, and they just saw young founders and they were always happy to help. And always, it's because they've been through that, you know? Yeah. And so I think just being able to have that culture of paying forward is really beneficial. And, we're doing the same thing now. You know, we'd like to stay in the space because we know they're growing and we know there's going to be a new young founders coming in, and we'd like to pay that forward as well. We know the struggle, and we're happy to help where we can. And the community is good. I mean, we have community events every now and then. Matt gave us some pancakes the other week. I'm trying to make that a weekly thing, but he won't budge. Like community drinks and everything. And it's very, very important just having a, you know, at the end of the day, you know, even if it's your dream job, it's still a job. And it's tiring, and it's good to just be surrounded with a community that goes, I understand. So that's a huge benefit, and not just to me, the rest of the team as well loves the fact that there's a community here that they can engage with that understand.
What aspects of Outset's involvement have you found to be the most valuable?
They have been very supportive in terms of connecting us within our industry, within locally as well, here in the New Zealand ecosystem and abroad as well. And so they give us all of these opportunities through their networks, and we're really grateful for that, for them to be open to introducing us to different people, whether they're customers or investors, or sometimes it's like the third degree connection, and that third degree connection becomes a very interested party in Denison. And I think just having that support directly and being here that has yielded massive success for Denison. It's a lot of what we found is that this job's a lot of serendipity. It's a lot of bumping into people, but sometimes there's a little bit of planned serendipity there, in terms of, you know, having the right networks, having like someone like Outset connect us to the right people. Some of the people that we know now, I never thought we would be engaged with on a week-to-week basis, day-to-day basis even. That's the type of support that I've really valued. Not saying that, you know, we tap their shoulders and bother them every day. You know, they're running a business as well, you know. And, yeah, but they're very willing to support where they can with their portfolio companies.
On a more personal note, what has been the most rewarding part of Denison?
I think the most rewarding part for me, I probably wouldn't say just to help my dad, because I think I feel like that success will take a few more years. But the most immediate rewarding thing that I can say, if I could just pick one thing that's been really rewarding about this journey, is just the people and the team that we've built, the advisors, the people like Outset, the people like my team, has been fundamental to everything, that all of the success Denison's had. Without my team, we wouldn't get as far as we did. Without Outset and our other stakeholders, we wouldn't have the connections that we have. Without our advisors all over the world, we wouldn't be as knowledgeable as we are with the market outside of New Zealand. It really is the people that make Denison a success. And so that would be the number one reward. You know, like, I come to work excited to do what I do, because I am surrounded with so many people who are passionate in their own way about what we do. It makes it very, it makes the challenges and the hardships very, very bearable. And, you know, and when you do hit those milestones, it's like, you know, it's just such an amazing feeling. I would hate to hit those milestones alone.
For potential entrepreneurs who are interested in starting up a deep tech company, looking back at when you started and where you started, do you have any words of advice?
Just start. it's called a startup for a reason. It really depends on the person and the founders, but I can only talk about my experience. From my experience, the biggest barrier has always been myself and my self-doubt and questioning myself. And I know this might be a bit it might be overstated already, but it really is true. You know, like, you are at least for me, I'm my worst judge. I'm fighting with my own demons. You just have to start, and just, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. You just don't know what you don't know. Like, even if I look up in hindsight, sometimes that question was hard, because it's like what could I have done differently? It's like, well, there's a lot of things I wish I could have done differently, but I just wouldn't have been able to do it differently because I just didn't know what I didn't know. Yeah, for I guess for young budding entrepreneurs out there who are starting their journey, just start there. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. There will be a lot of crises. There will be a lot of self-doubt. There will be a lot of anxiety-inducing times. But, you know, that challenge is worth it if it's something that you're really passionate about, you want to make, you know, that vision materialize. You know, just don't let yourself stop you, most of all. Talk to people. There are actually more people there that are willing to support you than you think. You know, I didn't think we'd get the supporters that we had when I first started, but like, I almost feel like I don't deserve it, you know, like some days are like, oh, why are you even helping me? You know, and it's because we believe in what you're doing. Yeah. And so for people who are maybe on the same boat, all of those things will happen. Just start. Never waste a good crisis, because crises will happen. Just don't waste it. Make the most of it.
That's good. Awesome. Thank you.
No worries.
Thank you for joining us at From the Outset. We look forward to having a chat with Mint Innovations in our next installment, talking about their massive growth and how they have opened their first big plant in Australia and their plans for the future. This is going to be one you don't want to miss, so stay tuned for our next episode. Cheers.